You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Esoteric Christianity and the Mission of Christian Rosenkreuz. This is Lecture 11, given in Nuremberg on the 2nd of December 1911, one of two lectures given. And it is entitled Faith, Love, Hope, the Third Revelation to Mankind, translated by Matthew Barton. This evening and tomorrow evening, we are going to attempt a coherent study of the being of man and of his connection with occult aspects underlying our present time and the near future. From various indications I have given here, you will have grasped that today we are, to some extent, facing a new revelation, a new annunciation to mankind. If we keep in mind the recent periods of man's evolution, it may well be that we shall best understand what is approaching if we connect it with two other important revelations. In doing so, we shall be considering, it is true, only what has been revealed to mankind in times relatively near to our own. These three revelations, the one now to come and the two others, may be best understood when compared with the early development of a child. Observing the child rightly, we find that on first coming into the world, it has to be protected and cared for by those around it. It has no means of expressing what is going on within it, or of formulating in thought what affects its soul. To begin with, the child cannot speak, cannot think. Everything must be done for it by those who have received it in their midst. Then it starts to speak. Those who watch it attentively, this is mentioned in my book titled The Education of the Child, will know that first it imitates what it hears, but that in the early days of talking, it has no understanding which can be attributed to thinking. What the child says does not arise out of thought, but the other way round. It learns to think by talking, learns gradually to apprehend in clear thought what previously it was prompted to say out of the obscure depths of feeling. Thus, we have three successive periods in the child's development. A first period, when it can neither speak nor think. A second, when it can speak, but not yet think. And a third, when it becomes conscious of the thought content in what it says. With these three stages in the child's development, we may compare what mankind has gone through and has still to go through since about 1500 years before the Christian era. The first revelation of which we can speak as coming to mankind during the present cycle of time is the revelation proceeding from Sinai in the form of the Ten Commandments. Anyone going more deeply into the significance of what was revealed to mankind in these commandments will find great cause for wonder. The fact is, however, that people take these spiritual treasures so much for granted that little thought is given to them. But those who reflect upon their significance have to confess how remarkable it is that in these Ten Commandments something is given which has spread through the world as law, something which in its fundamental character still holds good today, and forms the basis of the law in all countries, insofar as, during the last 1,000 years, they have gradually embraced modern civilization. Something all-embracing, grand, universal, is revealed to mankind, as if to say that there is a primal being in the spiritual world, whose image is here on earth, the ego. This being can so infuse his own power into the human ego, so pour himself into it, that man can follow the norms, the laws, given in the Ten Commandments. The second revelation came about through the mystery of Golgotha. What can we say about this mystery? What can be said was indicated yesterday in the public lecture, titled From Jesus to Christ. It was shown there how we have to trace back all physically embodied human beings to the original human couple on earth. And as we can understand man's bodily nature only as descending through the generations from this couple, so in order rightly to understand our ego's greatest gift, that must root itself more and more deeply into our ego during earthly existence, we must trace it back to the mystery of Golgotha. It need not here concern us that in this connection the old Hebrew tradition has a different conception from that of modern science. If we trace back mankind's blood relationship, its bodily relation, to that original human couple, Adam and Eve, who once lived on earth as archetypal individuals, as the primal forebears of mankind, and if we must therefore say that the blood flowing in people's veins goes back to that human pair, we can ask, where must we look for the origin of the most precious gift bestowed on our soul, that holiest, most valuable gift, which accomplishes in the soul never-ending marvels and makes itself known to our consciousness as something higher than the ordinary ego within us? For the answer, we must turn to what arose from the grave on Golgotha. In every human soul that has experienced an inner awakening, there lives on what then arose, just as the blood of Adam and Eve continues to live in the body of every human being. We have to see a kind of fountainhead, a primal fatherhood in the risen Christ, the spiritual Adam who enters the souls of those who have experienced an awakening, bringing them for the first time to the fullness of their ego, to what gives life to their ego in the right way. Thus, just as the life of Adam's body lives on in the physical bodies of all human beings, what arose from the grave on Golgotha flows in like manner through the souls of those who find the path to it. That is the second revelation given to mankind. We are able to learn what came about through the mystery of Golgotha. If in the Ten Commandments man has received guidance from without, this guidance may be compared to what happens to the child before it can either speak or think. What is done for the child by its environment is comparable to what the old Jewish law achieved for all mankind, which until then, as it were, lacked the power of speaking and thinking. People have now learned to speak, however, or rather have learned something that may be compared with a child's learning to speak. They have gained knowledge of the mystery of Golgotha through the Gospels. And the way in which they first understood the Gospels may be compared with how a child learns to speak. Through the Gospels, there has come to human souls and human hearts some degree of understanding for the mystery of Golgotha, which has found its way into human feelings and perceptions and into the soul forces arising in us when, for example, we allow the deeply significant, intuitive scenes and pictures drawn from the Gospels by great painters to work upon us. It is the same with traditional pictures, pictures of the adoration of the child by the shepherds or by the wise men from the East, of the flight into Egypt, and so on. All this leads back in the end to the Gospels. It has reached man's understanding in such a way that he may be said to have learned to speak, in his own fashion, about the mystery of Golgotha. Viewed in this way, we are now moving toward the third period, which may be compared with how the child learns the thought content in its own speech, and can become conscious of it. We are approaching the revelation which should give us the full content, the thought content of the Gospels, all they contain of soul and spirit. For at present the Gospels are no better understood than the child understands what it says before it can think. In the context of world history, people are meant to learn through spiritual science, to reflect upon the thoughts in the Gospels, to let the whole deep spiritual content of the Gospels work upon them for the first time. This is connected with a further great event which human beings can feel approaching, and which they will experience before the end of this 20th century. This event can be brought before our souls in somewhat the following way. If we return to the nature of the mystery of Golgotha, we realize that those elements of the Christ which rose from the grave of Golgotha have remained with the earth, so that they can directly affect every human soul, and can in each soul awaken the ego to a higher stage of existence. Speaking thus of the mystery of Golgotha, we may say, Christ then became the spirit of the earth, and since that time has remained so. In our day, however, a change in Christ's relation to man is coming, an important change, connected with what all of you have come to know something about, the new revelation to man of the Christ. This revelation can also be characterized in another way. For this, indeed, we must turn to what happens when a person goes through the gate of death. This is something that could not be described in books, but must now be spoken of. When a person has passed through the gate of death, has experienced the backward survey over his previous earthly life, and come to the point when his etheric body is laid aside, and the time has come for his Kamaloka, he first meets two figures. Usually only one is mentioned, but to complete the picture, and this is a reality for every true occultist, we must say that before his Kamaloka, a person is confronted by two figures. What I am now telling you holds good, it is true, only for people of the West, and for those who, during the last 1,000 years, have been connected with Western culture. A person after death is confronted by two figures. One of these is Moses. The person knows quite clearly that it is Moses who stands before him, holding up the tables of the law. In the Middle Ages, they spoke of Moses, quote, with his stern law, close quote. And in his soul, the person is keenly aware of how far in his inmost being he has transgressed against this law. The other figure is, quote, the cherubim with the flaming sword, close quote, who pronounces judgment on these transgressions. That is an experience a person has after death. Thus, in accordance with our spiritual science, it can be said that there is a kind of settlement of our karmic account by these two figures, Moses with the stern law and the cherubim with the flaming sword. In our time, however, a change is approaching, an important change. Christ is becoming Lord of Karma for all those who, after death, experience what has just been described. Christ is taking up the office of judge. Let us look more closely into this fact. From the world conception of spiritual science, we all know that a karmic account is kept of our life, that there is a certain balancing between the deeds on the credit side of the account, the sensible deeds, the fine deeds, those that are good, and on the other side, the bad, ugly, lying deeds and thoughts. Now, it is important that in the further course of a person's earthly life, he should himself adjust the balance of this karmic account. But this living out of the result of his good and splendid deeds, or those that are bad, can be done in many different ways. The particular adjustment in our future life is not always determined according to the same pattern. Suppose someone has done a bad action. He must compensate for it by doing a good one. This good action, however, can be achieved in two ways, and it may require the same effort on the man's part to do good only to a few people as to benefit a considerable number. To ensure that in future, when we have found our way to Christ, our karmic account will be balanced, made part of the cosmic order, in such a way that the settlement will benefit as many people as possible, that will be the concern of him who in our time is becoming Lord of Karma. It will be the concern of the Christ. This taking over by Christ of the judging of human deeds is a result of his direct intervention in human destiny. This intervention is not in a physical body, but on behalf of those people on earth who will increasingly acquire the capacity of perceiving him. There will be people, for instance, who, while carrying out some deed, suddenly become aware. There will be more and more cases of this from now on during the next 3,000 years, of an urge to step back from what they are doing because of a remarkable vision. They will perceive in a dreamlike way what appears to be an action of their own, yet they will not be able to remember having done it. Those who are not prepared for such a thing to happen in the course of their evolution will look upon it merely as imagination run wild, or as a pathological condition of the soul. Those, however, who are sufficiently prepared through the new revelation coming in our time to mankind by means of spiritual science, that is, through this third revelation during the latest cycle of mankind, will realize that all this points to the growing of new human faculties, enabling people to see into the spiritual world. They will also realize that this picture appearing to their soul is a forewarning of the karmic deed that must be brought about, either in this life on earth or in a later one, to compensate for what they have done. In short, people will gradually achieve, through their own efforts, the faculty for beholding a vision of the karmic adjustment, the compensating deed which must come about in future. From this fact it can be seen that in our time too, we should say, as did John the Baptist by the Jordan, change your state of soul, for the time is coming when new faculties will awake in human beings. But this form of karmic perception will arise in such a way that here and there, the figure of the etheric Christ will be directly visible, the actual Christ as he is living in the astral world, not in the physical body, but visible to the newly awakened human faculties. He will manifest on earth as counselor and protector of those who need advice, help, or solace in the loneliness of their lives. The time is coming when human beings who feel depressed and miserable for one or other reason will increasingly find the help of their fellows less important and valuable. This is because the force of individuality, of individual life, will count for more and more, while the power of one man to work helpfully upon the soul of another, which held good in the past, will constantly tend to diminish. In its stead, the great counselor will appear in etheric form. The best advice we can receive for the future is therefore to make our souls strong and full of energy, so that with increased strength, the further we advance into the future, whether in this incarnation, and certainly this applies to young people of today, or in the next, we may realize that newly awakened faculties give us knowledge of the Great Counselor, who is becoming at the same time the judge of human karma, knowledge, that is, of Christ in his new form. For those people who have already prepared themselves here for the Christ event of the 20th century, it will make no difference whether they are in the physical body, when this event becomes a widespread experience, or have passed through the gate of death. Those who have passed on will still have the right understanding of the Christ event and the right connection with it, but not those who have thoughtlessly passed by this third great annunciation to mankind given through spiritual science. For we must prepare for the Christ event here on earth while in the physical body. Those who go through the gate of death without even glancing at spiritual science during their present incarnation will have to wait until their next, before gaining a right understanding of the Christ event. The fact of the matter is that those who, on the physical plane, have never heard of the Christ event are unable to come to an understanding of it between death and rebirth. They too must wait until they can prepare for it on their return to the physical plane. Thus mankind now faces the mighty event referred to. Christ takes upon himself the office of judge and intervenes in an etheric body directly from the astral world in the evolution of mankind, becoming visible in various places among human beings. It is characteristic of human evolution, however, that old human attributes, not closely connected with spiritual evolution, gradually lose significance. When we consider human evolution, since the Atlantean catastrophe, we can say, among the great distinctions and differences prepared during the Atlantean age, present-day human beings have become accustomed to those of race. We can still speak in a certain sense of an old Indian race, of an old Persian race, of an Egyptian or a Greco-Latin one, and even of something in our own time corresponding to a fifth race. But the concept of race in relation to human evolution is ceasing to have a right meaning. Something that held good in earlier times will no longer do so in the sixth cultural epoch, which is to follow our own. Namely, that it was essential to have some geographical center from which to spread the culture of the epoch. The important thing is the spreading of spiritual science among human beings without distinction of race, nation, or family. In the sixth cultural epoch, those who have accepted spiritual science will come from every race and will found all over the globe a new culture no longer based on the concept of race, which will have lost its significance. In short, what is important in the world of Maya, the external world of space and location, vanishes away. We must learn to recognize this in the further development of our spiritual scientific movement. At the beginning, this was not understood. Therefore, we see how, when we read Alcott's book titled The Buddhist Catechism, which is otherwise so useful, we have the impression that races always go on like so many wheels. But for the coming time, such concepts are losing their significance. Everything subject to limitations of space will lose significance. Hence, anyone who thoroughly understands the meaning of human evolution understands also that the coming appearance of Christ during the next 3,000 years does not entail Christ being confined to a body bound by space, nor limited to a certain territory. Neither will his appearance be limited by an inability to appear in more than one place at a time. His help will be forthcoming at the same moment here, there, and everywhere. And as a spiritual being is not subject to the laws of space, anyone who can be helped by Christ's direct presence is able to receive that help at one end of the earth just as well as another person at the opposite end. Only those unwilling to recognize the progress of mankind toward spirituality and what gradually transforms all the most important events into the spiritual can declare that the Christ being is limited to a physical body. We have now described the facts concerning the third revelation, and how this revelation is already in process of throwing new light on the Gospels. The Gospels are the language, and in relation to them, anthroposophy is the thought content. As language is related to a child's full consciousness, so are the Gospels related to the new revelation that comes directly from the spiritual world, related, in effect, to what spiritual science is to become for mankind. We must be aware that we have, in fact, a certain task to fulfill, a task of understanding, when we come first out of the soul's unconscious depths, and then ever more clearly to discern our connection with anthroposophy. we must look upon it, in a sense, as a mark of distinction bestowed by the world spirit, as a sign of grace on the part of the creative, guiding spirit of the world. When today our heart urges us toward this new annunciation, this third revelation, added to those proclaimed from Sinai and then from the Jordan. To learn to know man in his entire being is the task given in this new annunciation. To perceive ever more deeply that the body we are principally conscious of is enclosed in other members of man's being, which are important for our whole life. It is necessary for our friends to learn about these matters from the most various points of view. Today we will begin by first saying a few words about man's inner being. You know that if we start from the actual center of his being, from his ego, we come next to the sheath to which we give the more or less abstract name of astral body. Proceeding further outward, we find the so-called etheric body, and still further outside, the physical body. From a real experience of life, however, we can also speak about the human sheaths in another way. Today we will take directly from life what can, it is true, be learned only from occult conception, but can be understood through unprejudiced observation. Many of those whom the so-called scientific worldview has made arrogant and overbearing now say, quote, "The ages of faith are long past. They were fit for mankind in their stage of childhood, but mankind has now progressed to knowledge. Today people must have knowledge of everything and should no longer merely believe." Close quote. Now, that may sound all very well, but does not rest on genuine understanding. We must ask more questions about such matters than merely whether, in the course of human evolution, knowledge has been gained through ordinary science. This other question must also be asked: does faith, as such, mean anything for mankind? May it not be part of a man's very nature to believe? Naturally, it might be possible that people should want, for some reason, to dispense with faith, to put it behind them. But just as one can get away with playing fast and loose with one's health without any obvious harm for a while, it might very well be, and is actually so, that people come to look upon faith merely as a well-worn gift granted to their fathers in the past. This is just as if, for a time, they were recklessly to abuse their health, thereby using up the forces they once possessed. When a person regards faith in that way, however, he is still, where the life forces of his soul are concerned, living on the old gift of faith handed down to him through tradition. It is not for man to decide whether to lay aside faith or not. Faith is a question of life-giving forces in his soul. The important point is not whether we believe or not, but that the forces expressed in the word faith are necessary to the soul. For the soul incapable of faith becomes withered, dried up as the desert. There were once people who, without any knowledge of natural science, were much cleverer than those who nowadays promote a scientific worldview. They did not say what people imagine they would have said, quote, "I believe what I do not know," close quote. They said, quote, "I believe what I know for certain," close quote. Knowledge is only the foundation of faith. We should know in order to take increasing possession of those forces which are forces of faith in the human soul. In our soul, we must have what enables us to look toward a supersensible world, makes it possible for us to turn all our thoughts and conceptions in that direction. If we do not possess forces such as are expressed in the word faith, something in us goes to waste. We wither as do the leaves in autumn. For a while this may not seem to matter, then things begin to go wrong. Were people really to lose all faith, they would soon see what it means for evolution. By losing the forces of faith, they would be incapacitated for finding their way about in life. Their very existence would be undermined by fear, care, and anxiety. To put it briefly, it is through the forces of faith alone that we can receive the life which should well up to invigorate the soul. This is because, imperceptible at first for ordinary consciousness, there lies in the hidden depths of our being something in which our true ego is embedded. This something, which immediately makes itself felt if we fail to bring it fresh life, is the human bodily sheath where the forces of faith are active. We may term it the faith soul, or, as I prefer, the faith body. It has hitherto been given the more abstract name of astral body. The most important forces of the astral body are those of faith. So the term astral body and the term faith body are equally justified. A second force that is also to be found in the hidden depths of our being is the force expressed by the word love. Love is not only something linking people together, it is also needed by them as individuals. When someone is incapable of developing the force of love, he too becomes dried up and withered in his inner being. We have merely to picture to ourselves someone who is actually so great an egoist that he is unable to love. Even where the case is less extreme, it is sad to see people who find it difficult to love, who pass through an incarnation without engendering in themselves the living warmth that only arises when we can love at least something on earth. Such people are a distressing sight, as in their dull, prosaic way they go through the world. For love is a living force that stimulates something deep in our being, keeping it awake and alive, an even deeper force than faith. And just as we are cradled in a body of faith, which from another aspect can be called the astral body, so are we cradled also in a body of love, or as we call it in spiritual science, the etheric body, the body of life forces. For the chief forces working in us from the etheric body, out of the depths of our being, are those expressed in a person's capacity for loving at every stage of his existence. If a person could completely empty his being of the force of love, but that indeed is impossible, even for the greatest egoist, thanks be to God, for even in egoistical striving there is still some element of love. Even someone who is unable to love anything else can often begin, if he is sufficiently avaricious, to love money, at least substituting for charitable love another love, albeit one arising from egoism. But if, as I was saying, there were no love at all in a person, the bodily sheath which should be sustained by love forces would shrivel, and the person empty of love would actually perish. He would really meet with physical death. This shriveling of the forces of love can also be called a shriveling of the forces of the etheric body, for the etheric body is the same as the body of love. Thus, at the very center of a human being, we have his essential kernel, the ego, surrounded by its sheaths. First the body of faith, and then round it the body of love. If we go further, we come to another set of forces we all need in life. And if we do not or cannot have them at all, well, that is very distinctly to be seen in our external nature. For the forces we need as life-giving, vitalizing forces are those of hope, of confidence in the future. As far as the physical world is concerned, people cannot take a single step in life without hope. They certainly make some strange excuses sometimes if they are unwilling to acknowledge that human beings need to know something of what happens between death and rebirth. They say, quote, "Why do we need to know that? when we don't even know what will happen to us tomorrow? So why are we supposed to know what takes place between death and a new birth? Close quote. But do we actually know nothing about the following day? We may have no knowledge of what is important for the details of our supersensible life, or to state it more bluntly, whether or not we shall be physically alive. We do, however, know one thing, that if we are physically alive, the next day there will be morning, midday, evening, just as there are today. If today as a carpenter I have made a table, it will still be there tomorrow. If I am a shoemaker, someone will be able to put on tomorrow what I have made today. And if I have sown seeds, I know that next year they will come up. We know about the future just as much as we need to know. Life would be impossible in the physical world were not future events to be preceded in this rhythmical way by hope. Would anyone make a table today without being sure it would not be destroyed in the night? Would anyone sow seeds if he had no idea what would become of them? It is precisely in outer physical life that we need hope, for everything is upheld by hope, and without it nothing can be done. The forces of hope, therefore, are connected with the last bodily sheath of our being, with our physical body. What the forces of faith are for our astral body, and the love forces for the etheric, the forces of hope are for the physical body. Thus someone who is unable to hope, someone always despondent about what he supposes the future may bring, will go through the world with this clearly visible in his physical appearance. Nothing makes for deep wrinkles, those deadening forces in the physical body, sooner than lack of hope. The inmost kernel of our being may be said to be sheathed in our faith body or astral body, in our body of love or etheric body, and in our hope body or physical body. And we comprehend the true significance of our physical body only when we bear in mind that in reality it is not sustained by external physical forces of attraction and repulsion, that is a materialistic idea, but has in it what according to our concepts we know as forces of hope. Our physical body is built up by hope, not by forces of attraction and repulsion. This itself can show us that the new spiritual scientific revelation gives us what is right, what we need. By revealing the all-embracing laws of karma and reincarnation, spiritual science gives us something which permeates us with spiritual hope, just as does our awareness on the physical plane that the sun will rise tomorrow, and that seeds will eventually grow into plants. It shows, if we understand karma, that our physical body, which will perish into dust when we have gone through the gate of death, can be rebuilt for a new life through the forces imbuing us with hope. Spiritual science fills people with the strongest forces of hope. Were this spiritual science, this new revelation for the present time, to be rejected, people would naturally still return to earth in future, for life on earth would not cease on account of people's ignorance of its laws. Human beings would incarnate again, but there would be something very strange about these incarnations. Human beings would gradually become a race with bodies wrinkled and shriveled all over, earthly bodies which would finally be so crippled that people would be entirely incapacitated. To put it briefly, in future incarnations, a condition of dying away, of withering up, would assail mankind if our human consciousness, and from there the hidden depths of our being right down into the physical body, were not given fresh life through the power of hope. This power of hope arises through the certainty of knowledge gained from the laws of karma and reincarnation. Already there is a tendency in human beings to produce withering bodies, which in future would become increasingly rickety, even in the very bones. Marrow will be brought to the bones, forces of life to the nerves, by this new revelation, whose value will not reside merely in theories, but in its life-giving forces, above all in those of hope. Faith, love, hope constitute three stages in the essential being of man. They are necessary for health and for life as a whole, for without them we cannot exist. Just as work cannot be done in a dark room until it is lit, it is equally impossible for a human being to survive in his fourfold nature if his three sheaths are not permeated, warmed through, and strengthened by faith, love, and hope. For faith, love, hope are the basic forces in our astral body, our etheric body, and our physical body. And from this alone, you can judge how the new revelation makes its entry into the world, permeating the old language with thought content. Are not these three wonderful words urged upon us in the gospel revelation? These words of wisdom that ring through the ages, faith, love, hope. But little has been understood of their whole connection with human life. So little that only in certain places has their right sequence been observed. It is true that faith, love, hope are sometimes put in this correct order, but the significance of the words is so little appreciated that we often hear faith, hope, love, which is incorrect, for you cannot say astral body, physical body, etheric body, if you would give them their right sequence. That would be putting things higgledy-piggledy, as a child will sometimes do before it understands the thought content of what is said. It is the same with everything relating to the second revelation. It is permeated with thought, and we have striven to permeate with thought our explanation of the Gospels. For what have these Gospels meant for people up to now? They have been something with which to fortify mankind, and to fill them with great and powerful perceptions, something to inspire people to enter into the depth of heart and feeling in the mystery of Golgotha. But now consider the simple fact that people have only just begun really to reflect upon the Gospels. And in doing so they have straightaway found contradictions upon which spiritual science alone can help to throw light. Thus it is only now that people will begin to let the thought content of the Gospels, given them in a language of supersensible worlds, work upon their souls. In this connection, we have pointed out what is so essential and of such consequence for our age. The new appearance of the Christ in an etheric body, for his reappearance in a physical body, is ruled out by the whole character of our times. Thus we have shown that the Christ, in contrast, as it were, to the suffering Christ on Golgotha, is appearing now as Christ triumphant, Christ the judge and Lord of karma. This has been foreshadowed by those who have painted him as the Christ of the last judgment. Whether painted or described in words, something is there represented which at the appointed time will come to pass. In truth, this begins in the 20th century and will not hold good until the end of the earth. It is in our 20th century that this judgment, this ordering of karma, begins. And we have seen how infinitely important it is for our age that this revelation should come to people so that even concepts such as faith, love, hope can be truly valued for the first time. John the Baptist said, "Change your mood of soul. The kingdom of heaven is at hand." That is, take to yourselves the human ego that need not diminish itself in order to approach the spiritual world. This points clearly to the important fact that with the event of Palestine, the time came for the supersensible to pour light into the ego of man, so that the heavens were able to descend into his ego. Previously, the ego could come to people only by sinking into their unconscious. Those who interpret everything materialistically say that the Christ, reckoning with the weaknesses, errors, and prejudices of his contemporaries, even foretold, like the credulous people of his time, that either 1,000 your kingdom would come about, or that a great catastrophe would befall the earth. Neither of these events, however, they say, came about. There was indeed a catastrophe, but perceptible only to the spirit. The credulous and superstitious who believe Christ to have foretold how he would literally descend from the clouds interpreted his meaning in a materialistic way. Today also there are people who interpret materialistically what is to be grasped only in spirit, and when nothing happens in a material sense, they judge the matter in just the same way as was done in the case of the 1,000-year kingdom. How many indeed we find today who, speaking almost pityingly of those things, say that Christ was simply influenced by the beliefs of his time and looked for the impending descent to earth of the kingdom of heaven. That was a weakness on Christ's part, they say. And then it was seen and remarked upon even by distinguished theologians that the kingdom of heaven has not come down to earth. It may be that people will meet our new revelation too in such a way that after a time, when the enhancement of human faculties is in full swing, they will say, quote, "Well, nothing has come of all these predictions of yours," close quote, not realizing that they just cannot see what is there. Thus do events repeat themselves. Anthroposophy is intended to gather together a large number of people in preparation of the fulfillment of what those with a right knowledge say, that during this century the new revelation and new supersensible facts are appearing in human evolution. These will then continue to unfold, becoming ever more significant throughout the next 3,000 years, until important new revelations are once more vouchsafed to mankind. The end of Lecture 11.